founded and influenced by Washington.
Obviamente,
the EU is mistaken in politically following the US meddlesome policy. The truth is, most political parties are running in these legislative elections.
Despite the aggression by the EU, the government of Venezuela says Maduro will go on as the country's president, and parliamentary elections will be held this year because Venezuela is a free country and it won't be brought to its knees by foreign sanctions. Jesus Silva Paracas.
In a somber silence, France marked 5 years since the November 15 attacks. 130 people were killed in what is the country's deadliest peacetime attack. Takfiri extremists linked to Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack as a response to France's military involvement in Syria and Iraq. Prime Minister Jean Castex led the commemorations as France finds itself in the midst of more Takfiri extremism and growing Islamophobia, polarizing the population. In the past few weeks, Takfiri extremists have killed 4 people after a series of Islamophobic statements from President Emmanuel Macron, as well as the overt promotion of blasphemous cartoons of Prophet Muhammad. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan also condemned Macron's rhetoric.
Mekke, Medine, Asya.
It is an issue of honor for us to stand against the attacks against our Prophet who honored the entire world. The West are once again heading for a period of barbarity. France and Europe in general, they don't deserve the policies of Macron and those with similar mindsets that spread seeds of hate.
French Muslim leaders have condemned all forms of violence and have called for restraint. France is also calling for a crackdown of foreign funding that it says stokes extremist sentiments. But wide-ranging condemnation of the entire Muslim community by politicians has only deepened divisions. Yesterday, France hosted the Paris Peace Forum, where leaders discussed the ongoing threat of extremism.
No one can say when the pandemic will stop, nor when terrorism will be vanquished. So we cannot wait. We must lead the fight back and build structures that will allow us to better foresee these global threats.
The 2015 attacks shocked the world and damaged relations between communities. President Macron has since tried to dampen emotions, but France remains at a crossroads. Any further Islamophobic sentiments will only flame the tensions.
Trump and his fellow Republicans keep insisting that the US presidential election was rigged, calling for a recount of ballots in several key states. Trump and his team have filed several lawsuits contesting the outcome of the election. However, they have suffered legal setbacks in 3 battleground states, namely Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Arizona. Courts there rejected Republicans' call for probing the vote count process and blocking mail-in ballots. Meanwhile, U.S. prosecutors have asked Attorney General William Barr to rescind a memo that instructed them to publicly investigate allegations of vote counting irregularities. The prosecutors say they have not seen any unusual activity. Barr sent his memo after days of attacks on the integrity of the election by President Donald Trump and his Republican allies. Although Trump has refused to concede defeat, he said in recent remarks that time will tell which administration will take office in the White House in January.
Whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be? I guess time will tell.
The remarks are the first indication that Trump could concede defeat in the disputed November 3rd presidential election. Still, some of Trump's supporters, as well as his fellow Republicans, are refusing to budge and remain hopeful that their candidate still has the chance to become the next president. The controversy over the election results comes against the backdrop of pro- and anti-Trump demonstrations. Trump supporters back his vote-rigging claims, while his opponents are happy with the projected victory of Joe Biden. Nevertheless, experts believe the nature of the U.S. regime will not change no matter who takes the reign at the White House.
What we're seeing is that the people who control both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, they want Trump out. You know, Trump is not perfect by any means. He's actually really bad for the American people. But the one thing that we can all give him credit is that he exposed the reality of the U.S. empire. He showed just how brutal it is. And I think for a lot of people on Wall Street and Washington who want to rebrand U.S. empire, Trump is too dangerous. And it's looking every day like Trump may be forced to concede.
Now, it remains to be seen who will be confirmed in office as the next U.S. president and whether or not there will be any major policy changes in the new administration.
On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The resolution also contained an arms embargo on Cairo and Ankara, motivated by concerns Europeans' arms and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland, and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept that countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The United States presidential election continues to be unfinished and disputed. Democrat Joe Biden holds a slim lead, but President Donald Trump has significant public support from Republicans at the grassroots and elite levels to not concede. The election was preceded by months of controversy regarding the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots, which appeared to swing the election in the slight favor of Joe Biden at the last minute. A recent poll showed that a whopping 70% of Republicans do not believe the election was free and fair. Polls held just prior to the vote showed just half the number of Republican skeptics. Democrats say vote fraud has not yet been proven and that Trump must concede to prevent increasing distrust towards the nation's electoral process. But this is the third disputed election in the last six tries. Many are insisting that this election must be judicially vetted in order to prevent even more alienation, apathy, abstention, and anger. Others say the economic, social, and health disaster caused by the coronavirus makes this not the year to insist on transparency.
Six elections, that's my entire lifetime. So one in two of elections in my lifetime, and only I've been able to only vote in the last, I think, three of them. Or four of them. That says a lot about people's uncertainty of these elections, and that's just only going to grow if the system remains how it is.
The repeated electoral chaos is likely to undermine perpetual U.S. claims that their model of democracy is not only the best, but should be emulated around the world. Harvard ranked U.S. election integrity just 57th in the world, and that was last year.
This is not a model of a political system that would want to be mimicked. And it would only be mimicked if it's being used by the powerful. It would only be mimicked by them because they want something that undermines a majority view. And you should reject that entirely. If you really are for the small D democracy, if you're really for that, you would reject the American model of electing presidents.
The corporate-dominated U.S. mainstream media appears to have a united front that Biden won the election and that any legal challenges are frivolous. A significant percentage of over 70 million Trump voters don't appear to agree. Weeks of chaos and tensions appear certain as the Electoral College, the vote which actually decides the U.S. president, doesn't meet until December 14th. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that indirect talks between Lebanon and Israel will continue over the maritime border demarcation, stressing that this does not mean it will lead to normalization. In a televised address to mark Lebanon's Martyr Day, Sayyid Nasrallah said the talks were instead meant to be technical and set limits so Lebanon can benefit from its natural resources.
Many have written that the maritime border negotiations would pave the way for normalization between Lebanon and Israel. This is empty talk. We will never be a part of any peace talks with Israel. We consider its existence to be cancerous and devilish, and this will never change.
Sayyid Nasrallah also commented on recent Israeli drills along the Lebanese borders, calling it a demonstration of strength the resistance has established. He said such exercises proved the Israeli army was in a difficult state, where it has shifted its activities from attacking to defending. Sayyid Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that Hezbollah has strong, lifelong powers that will help it overcome any Israeli maneuver against Lebanon and guarantee victory in the region. He also made similar remarks towards the U.S. administration. Commenting on the U.S. presidential elections, Sayyid Nasrallah said he was happy at President Donald Trump's, quote, humiliating downfall. However, he said America's foreign policy will stay in favor of Israel, despite a new administration. In regards to the recent U.S. sanctions against Lebanese officials, including Gibran Basil, Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. is seeking to cause political chaos in the country and remove the resistance force from the region. He stressed the plan was doomed to fail.
What gives a government like the American one, which commits all sorts of terrorism and corruption, the right to label our politicians as corrupt and sanction them? We need to act upon our sovereignty and stand up against those American policies.
Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. has failed its many attempts to pressure the resistance and turn the Lebanese people against Hezbollah through the war in Syria and the economic crisis in Lebanon.
These sanctions will do nothing. They will not affect internal relations or cause conflict in Lebanon. The U.S. has been trying for years to cause inner rivalry. It has tried to weaken the strongest component in Lebanon, which is the resistance. This U.S. failure is a victory for the resistance and the Lebanese people.
For his part, Sayyid Nasrallah praised Lebanese officials, including Minister Basil, for their courageous stance against the U.S. pressure, saying it was for the sake of the nation. Rana Alaeddin, Beirut.
Pakistan and Iran have moved forward to expand their bilateral cooperation in major fields. During Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's visit to Islamabad, both neighbors decided to expand their ties in the field of commerce, investment, regional connectivity, security, and people-to-people exchanges. The border management and geostrategic issues in the region linked with the security of both countries were at the center of the bilateral discussions. Iran has a long-standing concern over the back and forth movement of militants and smugglers at its shared porous border with Pakistan, something which also came under bilateral discussions.
We had a very good discussion on border cooperation, including border markets, as well as opening a new cross, a new border crossing in Rimdan Gabit between Iran and Pakistan, which will happen hopefully within a week or two.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the political uncertainty revolving around Afghan peace deal after the disputed presidential elections in the United States amid allegations of electoral fraud. It remains unclear on whether or not Joe Biden will withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan by May next year under a peace deal between the current U.S. administration and Afghan Taliban in early this year. The huge financial and military losses in the 19 years long war compelled the White House to have a deal with the Taliban largely on the terms and condition of the militants, something which many in the U.S. believe is a surrender deal.
On Afghanistan, we have almost similar views. Iran wants peace and stability in Afghanistan, so do we. We have decided to have more frequent discussions on Afghan situation.
Few weeks back, Donald Trump said that the U.S. forces are going to withdraw, even they will have the Christmas in America. They are that much in rush. But, you know, after the, Democratic government, when they come into power in January, so I think they have a fear of change in the policies. This is the most important subject which foreign minister of Iran and the Pakistani authorities discuss.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the hideouts of the Daesh militants in Afghanistan, which they fear may be harder to dismantle if the peace deal derails. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Clerics from major monotheistic religions gathered here in Tehran for an important goal: to promote peace based on religious commonalities. Delegates representing Islam, Christianity, and Judaism unanimously agreed that the root cause of intolerance and extremism lies in the lack of dialogue among religious leaders.
The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. The Holy Quran has a special chapter about Saint Mary and Moses. So religions don't have any issues with each other. Therefore, it is upon us scholars to raise awareness and enlighten the minds of our people to respect other religions.
This session comes against the backdrop of repeated acts of blasphemy in France against the sectaries of Muslims. Scholars slammed the French government for lending its support to the growing anti-Islamic rhetoric in the country. This as President Emmanuel Macron argues that he seeks to promote freedom of speech. These people say freedom of expression is praiseworthy as long as it does not contradict the right to freedom of religion.
What the French president says is merely based on his deeply entrenched racist mentality. His comments on Islam have nothing to do with free speech. His actions are aimed at spreading Islamophobia to further marginalize Muslims. Now you tell me, is this freedom of speech or is it suppression of Muslims' right to a free religion?
Iran is home to different religious minorities, from Christians and Jews to Zoroastrians. All are represented in the parliament. Scholars believe peaceful coexistence among religions hinges on a collective effort by religious leaders to sit and talk based on their commonalities.
Representatives of different religions here say what the French president describes as freedom of speech is in fact freedom of hate speech, not only against the sanctities of Muslims, but against all monotheistic religions, since they believe in the same God and honor each other's prophets. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight. According to data collected in mid-October, nearly 24 million U.S. adults, 10.9% of the population, report that their households sometimes or often did not have enough to eat recently. Between 8 and 14% of adults with children reported that their kids sometimes or often did not have enough to eat. Compare that to last year, where only 3.7% of adults reported their households going hungry during the entire course of 2019. Rates of hunger are much higher among Black and Latino households, where workers are more likely to work in low-income industries that suffered massive job losses due to the coronavirus pandemic. About 19% of Black households and 18% of Latino households reported not having enough food to eat, sometimes or often in the past 7 days. The Trump administration was in court last month, attempting to block emergency food assistance for the nation's poorest families. We have prepared for you an article written by Mike Ludwig. The piece is titled, 11% of U.S. adults go hungry as Trump and McConnell fixate on challenging election results. Please stay with us for more of Mike Ludwig's article. Federal data shows nearly 11% of American adults, including up to 14% of adults living with children, report their households do not have enough to eat. Hopes that Congress will pass another pandemic relief package before the end of the year are growing dim, as President Donald Trump fixates attention on trying to overturn the election that he and the U.S. media projected lost. Economic recovery is slowing as the United States experiences a surge of COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and deaths, threatening to send cities and states with high infection rates back into lockdown to prevent hospitals from becoming overwhelmed. The federal government estimates 10 million people, including 4 million children, will be pushed below the federal poverty line in late 2020 as unemployment benefit are set to expire in December without further relief from Congress. However, President Trump is now laser-focused on attempting to overturn the election result, pushing disinformation and conspiracy theories as his campaign files failing lawsuits challenging the vote. Recently, the U.S. media projected Joe Biden as the 46th President of the United States. According to the Washington Post, talks between the Trump administration and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on pandemic relief broke down last month, and administration officials have indicated they are unlikely to take the lead on negotiations now, leaving the job on the GOP side up to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell attempted to normalize Trump's unprecedented behavior, arguing before the Senate recently that Trump has the right to challenge the election in courts of law. Congress has failed to agree on pandemic relief since passing a $2.2 trillion package in the spring that provided stimulus checks starting at $1,200, with all eyes on two upcoming runoffs in Georgia that could wrest the Senate from his control. Mitch McConnell has said that passing another pandemic relief package before the end of the year is a priority. However, McConnell is pushing for a highly targeted stimulus package similar to a $500 billion proposal that Democrats rejected months ago, arguing it did not provide nearly enough economic relief. Democrats are doubling down on their proposal, the HEROES Act, a $2.2 trillion package passed by the House earlier this year that includes around another round of $1,200 checks to each individual, along with badly needed assistance for state and local governments. Mitch McConnell has consistently refused to take up the package in the Senate, where conservatives are wary of social welfare spending, rebelled against compromise measures offered by the Trump administration and the moderates. Democrats already cut $1 trillion from the HEROES Act since the House originally passed the legislation in May. Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and other top Democrats are now demanding Republicans drop their support for Donald Trump's effort to overturn the election and pass pandemic relief. Nancy Pelosi said during a press conference on Thursday, 12th of November, "What are they thinking? People are suffering. They seem to have a mental block to doing the right thing." Analysts say Senate Republicans are not likely to embrace a strong stimulus package now that Pfizer has claimed preliminary data showing that its COVID-19 vaccine is 90% effective. However, a trial for the vaccine is ongoing and has yet to be approved by the federal regulators. Consumer advocates warned recently that Pfizer's preliminary data does not show whether the vaccine is safe or whether it will effectively prevent COVID-19 in vulnerable populations. On Tuesday, 10th of November, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell claimed that unemployment has fallen to 6.9% as evidence that only a highly targeted stimulus package is needed. However, unemployment could spike again if the third wave of COVID-19 forces even more parts of the country back into shutdown. On Wednesday, 11th of November, Illinois issued guidance urging people to stay at home, and the city of Chicago will enter an official stay-at-home advisory beginning on Monday, 9th of November. Other states and cities will likely follow. A record 153,000 new COVID-19 cases were reported in the U.S. on Thursday alone, and the U.S. has seen over 1 million new cases in the past 10 days, more than any other nation in the world. According to the Economic Policy Institute, despite the positive jobs report claimed by Mitch McConnell, about 1 million Americans applied for unemployment insurance recently, more than any time during the Great Recession. Many workers are exhausting their state unemployment benefits as the pandemic drags on. The number of state claims dropped by 436,000 recently, and federal emergency unemployment benefits will expire on 26th of December without congressional action. Meanwhile, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the economy has not recovered from the damage caused earlier in the pandemic, as what little support is left from the initial relief package dwindles, and lower-income households and households of color are suffering the most. Nearly 80 million adults, about one in three, report not having enough money to cover basic expenses, such as food, rent, and medical bills, including 40% of households with children. According to the center's analysis of federal data, nearly one in six renters are behind on rent, including 26% of black families and 18% of Latino families. Some federal protections for renters are in place, but Democrats want a tougher eviction moratorium passed with a stimulus package. Attempts by landlords to evict their tenants have been reported across the country. According to data collected in mid-October, nearly 24 million adults, 10.9% of the U.S. population, report their household sometimes or often did not have enough to eat recently. Between 8 and 14% of adults with children reported that their kids sometimes or often did not have enough to eat. Compared to last year, when only 3.7% of adults reported their households going hungry during the entire course of 2019. Rates of hunger are much higher among black and Latino households, where workers are more likely to work in low-income industries that suffered massive job losses due to the coronavirus pandemic. About 19% of black households and 18% of Latino households reported not having enough food to eat, sometimes or often in the past 7 days. The Trump administration was in court last month, attempting to block emergency food assistance for the nation's poorest families. Back on Capitol Hill, Washington, according to reports, Democrats and Republicans remained deadlocked over pandemic relief on Thursday, 12th of November, with Democrats pushing their $2.2 trillion proposal and attacking Republicans for focusing on Donald Trump's efforts to reverse the election results. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said he wants Congress to pass another stimulus package but continues to stand by his $500 billion offer. Mitch McConnell said, "I gather Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leader in the Senate still are looking at something dramatically larger." He added, "That's not a place I think we're willing to go."
Debate. Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Israel is speeding up its illegal activities and is planning to build more than 1,200 new settler units on occupied land. The U.S. administration of Donald Trump has given its nod of approval, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is set to visit the occupied territory later this week. Why isn't the United Nations condemning and punishing the culprits for going against international law? We will look at all of this in this debate. I'd like to start it off crossing over to Ramallah and talking to Mona Kandil. Mona, fill us in on the latest situation of what's going on in the region and also with Pompeo's visit coming up in a couple of days, reaction-wise.
Well, the submitting of the tenders for building 1,200 new settler units in the heart of Jerusalem Al-Quds in one of the legal settlements known as Givat Hamotes comes only several days before the visit of U.S. Secretary of State to the illegal settlement of Pisagot near Ramallah. And it's the first time when a U.S. Secretary of State will be carrying out such a visit to the region. It seems that the Israeli regime is trying to raise the time and to impose more facts on ground before the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden, because the deadline for submitting the tender is January 18, only 2 days before the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Now, these new units would cut off the city of Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank from Jerusalem Al-Quds, and also it will cut off one of the Palestinian villages called Beit Safafa. It's in the heart of Jerusalem Al-Quds from the surrounding villages. This comes at a time when the Palestinians cannot build or even expand on their own lands in the city of Jerusalem Al-Quds and even in the occupied West Bank, where their lands are very close to the illegal settlements.
Mona, can you just briefly explain what exactly this means when we say, for example, Palestinians will not be able to get to Bethlehem or other areas will be cut off?
Well, now the new units that will be built in the illegal settlement of Givat Hamutas, it would be built in an area beyond the pre-1967 borders. These areas, according to any agreement in the future, Palestinians have the right to have their independent state, including the occupied West Bank, Gaza Strip, and eastern part of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Now, building in that area, in the heart of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, Palestinians living in Beit Lahem will have no access to go to Jerusalem, Al-Quds, even the areas where it's cut off by the separation wall, there will be complete control from the Israeli military. Families will find themselves, half of the family would be in that part of Jerusalem, of course, and half of the families would find themselves in the areas of Beit Lahem and in the occupied West Bank. There will be relatives divided in two areas after building these units, because of course the Israeli military will have to seize the land in order to make it possible for the settlers to expand to build the new units.
Thank you so much for that update out of Ramallah. That's Mona Kandil. I'd like to welcome one of my guests to the program, Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief of the International Interests out of London. Thanks so much for being with us. I mean, we've been talking a few minutes already about these 1,200 new settler units. Why do you think that Israel has chosen this time to do this and in this way?
I think under the Trump administration, Trump gave a free license and dropped full makeup. He dropped all the pretense of diplomacy that the U.S. foreign policy has entailed with regards to the Palestine-Israel issue. By makeup, what I mean is that he recognizes that the U.S. believes that Israel should exist. The U.S. is committed. The U.S. is committed for that is committed to ensuring that the Palestinians are not allowed to retake their land. But what Trump did was he dropped this idea that the Palestinians, that the there was a viable two-state solution possible and that they would support it. Trump essentially asserted that Israel can take all the land that it pleases, it can keep going through those settlements, and when it's ready to calm down, U.S. or Trump will force the Palestinians to accept any settlement. But Biden, however, is going to bring back that diplomacy. He's going to bring back that makeup. He's going to try to bring about a new discussion, new negotiations between the Palestinians and Israelis, not with any hope of there actually being a lasting solution, but with the idea that the U.S. is now appearing more responsible than Trump is willing to listen.
Well, stay with me with that. I want to get into that part of it a little bit later in the program. Let me get in out of London, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer. Welcome to the program. Now, Jonathan, what is it about the Israeli regime that it appears the U.S. is willing to support it under any circumstances? Now we're looking at it with its illegal occupation and building of settler units, and even Pompeo is going to be going to the region. So what is it about Israel for the U.S.?
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that although all American administrations in recent history have been very pro-Israel, nonetheless, Donald Trump's administration has been extreme in its support. And this is largely because a fundamental base of his support is amongst evangelical Christians who have a peculiar idea that there will be a second coming of Jesus Christ in Israel in their lifetime. And when that happens, there will be what they call the rapture, and all good Christians will be taken up into heaven, and hard luck for everybody else. Might seem to us a rather extreme point of view, but that is what many American evangelical Christians believe. And so when Trump has been in power, while he's been in power, we've seen him really giving a green light to everything that Israel wanted to do. He moved the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He recognized the Golan Heights, which is occupied Syrian territory, as legitimately Israeli, and basically has not opposed settlements, which is one thing, however, that I think Joe Biden will do. I think he will argue for a freeze on settlements, which is why the Israelis are now determined to do as much as they can as quickly as possible before Joe Biden gets in.
All right. Well, Sami, do you think that if anyone had any hope of a united Palestinian state, that this move basically drives a nail in the coffin for that so-called two-state solution? Because now even Palestinians are cut off from other Palestinians in other parts of that region.
I don't think anybody is particularly serious about the two-state solution. I always argue that the two-state solution was a political framework within which to temper any Palestinian resistance towards taking the whole land, because the premise of a two-state solution is not the idea of justice, but how much injustice the international community is prepared to allow. In other words, how much Palestinian land should we give to Israel, as opposed to restoring all of it to the Palestinians? So I always think that the problem with the two-state solution is not necessarily whether people believe in it or not. The problem with the two-state solution is that in its very essence, it's designed to deny the rights of the Palestinians and ensure that there is no resistance to the Israelis, with the support, of course, of the international community. I think if anybody did have hope in the two-state solution, if the fact that Israel has been expanding rapidly, and if the fact that Palestinian territory now operates, it is underpinned by extensive security agreements with Israel. You pass through checkpoints, which are now going to be developed even further by the UAE following its normalization of ties. I think if anybody still believes in the two-state solution today, is either has been sleeping for the past few decades or quite simply is delusional.
Well, Jonathan, shouldn't there be international uproar about all of this illegal activity, such as the building of these illegal settlements, the cutting off of access to Palestinians, and a U.S. official visiting occupied territory, and basically giving the green light to something that is illegal? Your take on that, and why aren't we seeing that uproar?
Well, what we are seeing, Marzia, is protests, not uproar, unfortunately, yet, but certainly most Western governments, with the exception of the United States, of course, have repeatedly condemned these ongoing settlements in the occupied territories and regard them as being illegal under international law. And that's the case with Britain, it's the case with the EU, and so on, and so on.
Well, Jonathan, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you say that many of these Western governments have continually protested, but what does that mean if it's not backed by actions? We've seen these same Western countries, when they wanted to protest, or when they saw what they call illegal activity, what they can go in and do, whether we're talking about Libya, or we're talking about Iraq, or we're talking about Syria. What does a slap on the hand, what does it do for the Palestinian people when continually their rights are being taken and basically nothing is being done by this international community, Jonathan?
Well, I agree that not enough is being done by the international community in real terms, whether it's sanctions of some kind or more international political pressure. The only thing that's happened so far is, for example, that the EU insists that any products of illegal settlements are clearly marked as such and not as produce of Israel, so consumers in the EU and elsewhere can choose themselves whether they wish to boycott those products. But I think many friends of Palestine, including myself, would argue very strongly that that just doesn't go far enough, and it really is time to take much, much stronger action. After all, it's not just that Israel is breaking international law, it's that the Palestinians are constantly suffering, and this goes on, and it's an absolutely unacceptable situation.
Sami, do you think that it will make a difference if there is a Biden Harris White House as opposed to the Trump White House that we have now?
I think the only difference will be in the pace that Israel expands as opposed to anything else. Biden is committed to Israel. The U.S. policy is committed to seeing Israel established. If that's established at the expense of the Palestinian state, then that's realpolitik. U.S. will argue that's the reality of the situation. U.S. is pushing other Arab states to normalize ties. Biden welcomed UAE normalization of ties. And I think it's important to understand that whenever we're talking about the Palestine-Israel issue, we should be wary about the manner in which we talk about it. This is a resistance against a colonizer. Nelson Mandela was a terrorist until his resistance succeeded, and then he became a symbol of peace for the powers that were supporting apartheid. Algeria, where I am from, 132 years they fought the French. In that period, French rule was recognized in Algeria. Charles de Gaulle, when France was liberated in World War II, they proceeded to crush the independence bid in Algeria, which then ignited the war for independence. We should be talking about the Palestine-Israel issue not as a bid to justify an injustice via the two-state solution, but as a bid of a foreign colonizer that has taken land. There is a resistance. It's the Palestinian resistance. The international community prefers the colonizer today, but I do believe that what defines the politics of conflict is power. If the Palestinians can get enough power and reverse the situation and take back their land, they will be recognized. If Israel has the power and obliterates the Palestinians, the international community will recognize Israel. Until then, we will see statements, but no real action. The key crux is power. The Palestinians lack it. The Israelis have it. But history shows that these things don't last. And it may well be that in the next 10, 15, 20 years, we may see a shifting in the dynamics. But it will not come from Biden. It will not come from the U.S. The U.S. is committed to the establishment of Israel, even if that's at the expense of the Palestinians. And the U.S. will be deploying all of its foreign policy. Biden will deploy all of his diplomacy to ensure that just as the UAE recognized Israel, all of the Arab states do so. And we will see the pace of Israel slow down in order to create an environment that is conducive for the Arabs to accept it. And we will see social engineering methods in which they will try to create a new generation that will say, forget the hate of the past, forget the injustice of the past, forget the fact that your grandfathers were kicked out of their land. Let's all be free and just accept the injustice for what it is and move on. That's Biden's policy, and that's why it remains an even greater danger than Trump, who was quite open about what he wanted, as opposed to Biden, who will put the makeup back on U.S. foreign policy and make people like me and everybody else who calls out the policy for what it is to appear to be the madman, as opposed to the administration of Donald Trump, where it seemed perfectly acceptable and reasonable to say, this is the ugly face of the U.S. and it needs to be stopped.
What about that, Jonathan? You heard our other guests there in London, Sami, that basically under a Trump regime, things were more black and white when it came to the Palestinian situation. It was blatant support of Zionist expansion, whereas under other governments, for example, now a Biden government, if we look at the past, what Democrats have done, basically more or less backing the same type of methods being used in Israel, but with nicer words, or talks about uniting and talks with Palestinians and Israelis. And it, basically what our guests said, other guests said, is making those who support the Palestinian cause actually look like the madmen or terrorists.
Well, I know where Sami is coming from, but I don't agree with him that a Biden presidency is going to be even worse than Donald Trump. I think that's almost impossible. Biden has, of course, said that he is a friend of Israel. We shouldn't fool ourselves that he's going to do anything like, for example, removing the U.S. embassy from Jerusalem back to Tel Aviv. Don't think that's going to happen. What I do think is, however, he will try to put pressure on to the Israeli government to slow down or preferably freeze settlements. We may all think that he should do much more than that, but I think that would be one stage, one more progressive stage. In the future, who knows about US administrations? I mean, had Bernie Sanders won the Democrat nomination, though that was never going to be very likely, let alone win the presidency, we would have seen a very different American policy. And I think it's important to recognize that an American public opinion, even amongst many American Jews, has really shifted on Palestine. And many Americans, particularly younger Americans, are outraged by what they see going on in the occupied territories. And I think, therefore, the background mood is changing dramatically, though the governments haven't yet caught up with that.
Well, Sami, at the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009, during another transition period of presidents in the U.S., we saw extreme aggression against Palestinians by Israel with an all-out war against Gaza. Is Tel Aviv once again taking advantage of the chaos existing in the U.S. to basically do whatever it can against Palestinians while the world is looking elsewhere?
Your question suggests that the U.S. is against what Israel is doing in Palestine, or that the U.S. is disturbed by what Israel is doing in Palestine. I don't necessarily think that the U.S. is. It might be a change of tactics, as Professor Jonathan alluded to correctly, in that Trump was more aggressive. Biden is going to tell them, listen, don't kill them fast, kill them slowly, to put it in more cruder terms. I think Biden is going to say, let's talk, let's try to come up with a diplomatic solution. But I think we should always be wary. And the reason I say that it's a power play as opposed to a moral or a diplomatic game is because we look at situations where the U.S. has imposed itself and forced a solution. We look at, for example, Bosnia, which is paralyzed by the Dayton agreement and has been unable to move, but the U.S. still considers it a major success. I think the reality is that the Palestine-Israel issue, we still today do not talk about it in brutally honest terms. And I think that's because of the power dynamics. If you're talking about resistance, the Palestinians don't have the power today to take their land, and therefore they cannot dictate the narrative. When we're talking about freezing settlements, as Jonathan correctly said, we are not talking about reversing them. When Trump moves the embassy, Biden may have opposed it, but he's not going to reverse it. Biden may oppose the settlements, but he's not going to reverse it. Biden may oppose expansion, but he's not going to reverse it. In other words, Biden is going to accept the power play as it is, which is that Israel is strong, Palestine is weak. And if Israel transgresses or oversteps the mark, the U.S. is not going to tell them to pull back, but tell them, we didn't like it, please don't do it again. And then Israel is going to continue again. The U.S. says, we don't like it, please don't do it again. And then Israel does it again. This is the pattern that we're seeing. And that's why I think the only solution to the Palestine-Israel issue really is if you see a genuine change in the power dynamics. But when you look at everything, Egypt facilitating the blockade of Gaza, Saudi Arabia considering normalization, UAE already normalizing ties, Sudan now at the mercy of the U.S., which is dictating the conditions for the return of its integration, Iran under economic sanctions, Assad considering normalization in exchange for a relaxation of the pressure, Caesar sanctions, or the like. The reality is that all the power dynamics are heavily in favor of Israel. So nobody, not even Bernie Sanders, who said in an Al Jazeera interview that he is against the one-state solution because it would mean that the Arabs are the majority. Bernie Sanders said this. In other words, I think there are two solutions to the Palestine-Israel conflict. One is either outright retaking of land by the Palestinians by force, or two, a one-state solution. Israel rejects the one-state solution because it knows that in a democratic environment of a one-state solution, the land goes back to its the people that it belongs to, and Israel believes that its current position as a state is built on brute force, built on injustice, and built on the biggest superpower on earth, giving it unconditional support on everybody who comes against everybody who tries to come and assert their rights.
And on that note, we're out of time, but I appreciate both of you being with us, both of you coming out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and lecturer, Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief of the International Interests. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time.